This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Catherine Fritke, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. For the week of August 28th, here are a few top stories. In the news, a week after a visit from President Trump spurred chaotic protests in downtown Phoenix, the city council had the option to approve an external review of the police response at a recent council meeting. But as KJZZ's Casey Kuhn reports, the meeting was taken over by protesters.
After the first 15 minutes of public comment, when Mayor Greg Stanton tried to move on with the meeting, protesters flooded the chamber aisles demanding to be heard. The mayor declared a short recess, left the room, and came back with an option: move up the agenda item calling for a $45,000 external review of police actions last Tuesday. Nearly every speaker at the five-hour-long meeting spoke against the review and gave testimony on what they saw the night of the rally. That included resident Gina Mendez.
And y'all let the police department mess up that day. Y'all should be ashamed.
The several residents who spoke in favor of police actions were soon drowned out by boos and chants from those against. Council members then discussed the review, requested by City Manager Ed Zuercher on Monday. Almost all were against it, either because it second-guessed police or because it wasn't independent enough. So Zuercher pulled his recommendation for the item, making a vote impossible.
My attempt here was to respond to concerns for independent fact-gathering, but it's apparent that my proposal is not viewed as objective, and so therefore I would respectfully withdraw my recommendation for this item.
The first of 12 community and police listening sessions is September 5th at 6 p.m. Casey Kuhn, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And from our ongoing series on the opioid crisis, here's the latest story. Like much of the country, Arizona is grappling with an opioid epidemic. More than 800 people died from opioid overdoses in 2016, and deaths from heroin have tripled in recent years. Governor Doug Ducey recently declared a public health emergency. KJZZ's Will Stone follows one local woman who has taken the matter into her own hands.
It's just after 9 on Saturday morning, and a young woman in scrubs loads up her sedan with boxes of sterile water, band-aids, and syringes. She's ready for deliveries.
She's got kind of a list of everybody that we're going to see, where they're located.
She's one of the volunteers with a group called A Shot in the Dark, Phoenix's underground needle exchange.
Some of us are people who use drugs, some of us are people who used to use drugs.
She's nervous talking about this. Her day job is in social work, so we're not using her name. While dispensing needles isn't technically illegal, distributing or possessing drug paraphernalia is a felony under Arizona law. Because of that, it's difficult to get any public support. Everything her group does is word of mouth. The premise?
Just because you're using drugs doesn't mean that your health care doesn't matter, and doesn't mean that there's nothing that can be done.
Needle exchanges are a classic example of the concept of harm reduction, an umbrella term for reducing the negative consequences of drug use, like HIV and hepatitis C, without forcing people to be abstinent. More than 30 states have syringe exchanges. Some are publicly funded, others more informal. Arizona has a few in the South, but for years, A Shot in the Dark has been the only option in Phoenix.
As people become more aware of us, we're getting more and more requests, which is a really good thing. I just wish we could do more.
Soon, we're at our first stop. A middle-aged woman emerges from a small house with a tiny lawn.
Hey.
They make small talk as she fills a bag for her, and then they part ways.
She was asking me for naloxone. Unfortunately, we don't have any right now.
That's the opioid overdose reversal drug. Arizona has recently made efforts to expand access, passing a law that lets people buy it without a prescription, and trying to get law enforcement to carry it. But she says it's still not getting to enough people who use drugs.
Part of it is affordability, part of it is access, but I think the biggest part is people fear the discrimination that comes along with asking.
The state's actually now tracking who buys naloxone in hopes of collecting more data, but she says that only adds to the unease among users. Some are even suspicious of her at first. We're at a trailer park now. Four people come to the idling car. One man looks impatient, anxious. When he reaches for the syringes, his arm reveals an abscess, wider than a baseball.
I've got some antibiotic ointment.
Yeah, it takes a
minute. Then he hurries back inside.
Man, oh man.
Yeah, just that was... I mean, that was a pretty obvious severe infection. But you saw his reaction when I was like, see a doctor or something? You know, he was like, immediately walked away.
And that's typical. People don't want to go to the doctor for any reason. They're worried about being arrested or put on a list.
We're the only people that are left that will talk to them because their family has cut off contact. You know, everybody in their entire life pretty much telling them to get off drugs.
But she doesn't tell them that, only referring them to a doctor or treatment program if asked.
Like, we're not just giving people needles.
Many still believe syringe access programs enable drug use, but the Centers for Disease Control say that's not the case. In fact, some research shows people who access these programs are 5 times more likely to get treatment than those who don't.
It's the craziest thing. You tell people that their lives matter, you tell them you care about your health, and they start to believe it, and they decide that they want to change something.
She's seen both sides, having worked in addiction for years, telling people as they leave detox to stay 100% abstinent, while knowing the statistics show how unlikely that is.
I got involved with this because I didn't feel like I was actually helping anyone. And now I think I am.
In 2016, she says they gave out more than 500,000 syringes, more than 1,000 naloxone kits. But without steady funding, they're running low on money and supplies.
You know, a group of community members decided to start doing this because of the complete inaction of the Arizona government.
Many would disagree that the state's done nothing. There have been laws to curb opioid prescribing, for example. And over the summer, health officials have been collecting data and coming up with a comprehensive plan, one that she hopes just might include a program like theirs. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In the world of business, a huge greenhouse facility north of Wilcox is growing tomatoes, but they're not using traditional methods to produce the crop. They're using artificial intelligence. KJZZ's Casey Kuhn reports this kind of high-tech farming will grow our future food.
So just washed my hands. We're about to head to the greenhouse. I've got a hairnet on and I'm about to get some gloves.
Walking into Tomato Company Nature Suite's greenhouse is like walking into Willy Wonka's chocolate factory. The long hall between the grow houses bustles with workers moving tomatoes and shouting directions.
Hey, this one, first harvest? So this is the first harvest.
The general manager, Gustavo Vera, shows me the rows of tomato plants growing up, heavy with nearly ripe green tomatoes. He explains how the 8-week process to get them to this point is done very carefully.
Growing tomatoes is an art. So the grower needs to balance out several conditions at the same time.
Conditions like humidity, temperature, irrigation, pest control, and the list goes on. We're in one of the 16 greenhouses on site, which NatureSuite took over a few years ago. They've changed the operation, and now they're trying out a technology you wouldn't expect to see in rural Arizona. Artificial intelligence.
This is going to revolutionize the industry, I believe, because what was an art now has a data backup.
Back in his office, Vera shows me a dashboard on his computer collecting data sent from the newly installed cameras in the greenhouse.
And this tells us, okay, of out of the houses that you have, which ones do have control operations?
He points to different charts and numbers that are constantly changing. It looks like the flight deck of a science fiction spaceship. But rather than star cluster maps, we're looking at an overhead shot of the tomato grow house we were just in. Instead of plants, they're little dots in rows and rows. He clicks on a data layer and a few pop up as red. And that means those plants have pests. They're exact pinpoints that show growers where to find the problem crops. It's this type of data collection over time that becomes the artificial intelligence. Agriculture technology specialist Robin Lawson says it's not the kind of AI that can take over the world.
Artificial intelligence has such this negative connotation. I immediately think of all of those sci-fi movies from Hollywood, and that's not what's happening.
She says it's large-scale data analytics that farmers are using nowadays as the labor availability becomes more limited and expensive. Growers have access to robot sensors, aerial imagery, and hundreds of apps to help manage their fields. Lawson says cutting-edge technology and agriculture have always gone hand in hand, but now it's developing at a rapid pace.
And it's almost oversaturated data. There's some times where growers are like, this is too much, I don't even know how to put this together to make decisions.
That's where the central data system in Wilcox comes in. The countless data workers like irrigation technologist Juan Mosqueda collect comes through a central app that all the specialists have on their phones.
So we can all see it. So now the only thing is I have to show you. If I can't show you on this one.
The only problem is the Wi-Fi connection isn't good in this giant greenhouse. The app is slow to start up, but Mosqueda can still input data. Once he reaches a working signal, it goes through. It's an upgrade from the pen and paper he's always used.
We don't have to carry any of the papers anymore. All the information is all in the same place. It gives us some nice grabs when we go to it.
And as farming technology keeps getting smarter, tech specialist Lawson says there may be a point where the plant itself could tell a grower from a sensor in the seed that it needs more water.
I think in the very near future that we're going to have sensors on each plant. In my lifetime, I think we'll start to see that.
It might be a while before that happens, but there's no doubt the future of farming is going digital. Casey Kuhn, KJZZ News, Wilcox.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. And now, here's a segment from KJZZ's original production, The Show.
Now, Steve, most of your family either lives in town or is from here, so they kind of understand. But most of my family is not here. And they ask me sometimes, how do you handle the heat during the summer? We're still going to see highs above 100 next month. And for people from cooler places, it's frankly unfathomable.
Mark, I'm really hoping you don't respond, well, it's a dry heat.
I have never once said that after living here. I tell them about the wonders of air conditioning. There are times when it's 100 outside, but you need a light jacket in some of the buildings around here.
Yeah, even in the huge buildings like stadiums or theaters or malls.
Yeah, and what you might not know is some of those major buildings downtown are all cooled by the same system.
Okay, I'm legitimately surprised by that.
Yeah, the Talking Stick Resort Arena, Comerica Theater, the Sheraton Hotel, they're all cooled by the biggest version of an air conditioner you've ever heard of, and it's right under the street. The show's Annika Klein takes us down on a tour.
And here's our guide.
Here, we'll take a tour through the plant.
Gary Cheek doesn't actually do a whole lot of tours. He's the director of operations and maintenance at the NRG Energy Center that sits under downtown Phoenix.
It's pretty much invisible. People have no idea this plant's underneath the street.
They actually have three main plants around here. We're in the convention center plant, and we're looking at what Cheek calls the ice tanks.
The water level in here is about 26 feet deep.
It looks like a really big swimming pool.
For the most part, it's about 32 degrees in here.
It would be a really cold swimming pool, but the temps are perfect for a system that cools more than 40 buildings.
This is a chilled water pipe that's returning from the customers.
It's incredibly noisy right where the action happens, but Cheek is explaining that the blue pipes above our heads are bringing back water from customers. 4 miles of pipe under the streets deliver the chilled water to keep air conditioners blasting cold air. Then the water comes back to be chilled again.
Our water just keeps going around in a circle out to the system, to the customers and back, 24/7, 365.
Where we're standing over the ice tanks is just below the intersection of Washington and 3rd Streets. The people standing above us on the sidewalk can see Symphony Hall, the Phoenix Convention Center, and the Bank of America Tower. All three are customers of the NRG Energy Center.
All of Cityscape is on here, the retail and the office building, a Comerica Theater, 4th Avenue Jail, County.
And their top customer, at least when the Diamondbacks play a home game, is Chase Field.
They'll take about 7,000 tons of cooling. And if you think of your house, you know, the house has maybe a couple of 3 or 4 ton units on it.
Fans watching the game behind home plate rely on an enormous amount of cooling capacity compared with those watching on the TV at home. What's more, Chase Field does not insulate its field from the heat of the day. They want the sunshine to come in, Cheek says.
If the ground gets cold, the grass turns yellow. And yellow grass on television doesn't look good for baseball. So even during the summer when it's 115 or 118 outside, they keep the roof open, get all that sunshine and heat on the grass. And then about 2:30 in the afternoon before a 6:40 game, they start pre-cooling.
And by the first pitch, you have happy grass and happy people. A balance that was trickier when Chase Field wasn't connected to a district system 17 years ago. The Diamondbacks notes on its website that the old air conditioning method didn't cool the ballpark down as quickly. That meant they couldn't keep the roof open for as long as they can now. It's also more expensive and burdensome for buildings like Chase Field to run their own systems, to take care of upkeep and upgrades. Whether it's a ball game or a conference, the venues around here are able to keep visitors cool when they need to, but don't have to worry about the system that does all the work. During our tour, we exit the plant through a door, and suddenly we're standing on the carpet in one of the convention center halls.
They're very event-driven, so, you know, right in the middle of the summer, we've had 100,000 people come through here. Doors are open, the cold air's flying out, but inside it stays nice and cool.
Other areas in Arizona have taken a liking to district energy in the past couple decades, too.
Tucson now uses a similar system at its convention center. The ASU Tempe and Polytechnic campuses have them too. And now, thanks to a construction boom, NRG is scouting locations for a fourth downtown Phoenix plant, one that someday more pedestrians and cars will pass over without knowing what's right below their feet. For the show, I'm Annika Klein.
Last Sunday, just 5 days before the second round of renegotiations on the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, President Trump criticized Mexico on Twitter again. And the neighboring country replied by offering support for Hurricane Harvey victims. From KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau, Rodrigo Cervantes reports.
President Trump tweeted last Sunday that Mexico is one of the nations with highest crime and will have to pay for the border wall. He also wrote that Mexico and Canada have been difficult to deal with during NAFTA talks. But in response, Mexico has offered help after the devastations of Hurricane Harvey, quote, as good neighbors should always do in trying times. The Secretary of Foreign Affairs stated that he spoke to Texas Governor Greg Abbott. The Mexican government also replied that it will not pay for a wall, clarifying that drug-related violence is a shared problem and that their country will continue renegotiating NAFTA, but not through social media. Rodrigo Cervantes, KJZZ News, Mexico City.
In science news, Hurricane Harvey caused widespread damage this week, but are these types of storms going to be more common? Here's the show's Mark Brody.
As the rain continues to fall in southeastern Texas, Harvey is expected to bring torrential rains to southwest Louisiana as well. That's what the National Weather Service is forecasting. Researchers are looking into the effect climate change may be having on storms like this one. With me to explain is Ben Kurtman. He's a professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Miami. And Ben, has the Gulf of Mexico been affected differently by climate change than other places?
Well, I wouldn't say it's necessarily different than other places. The way to think about what's going on in terms of climate change is the Gulf of Mexico is certainly warming up, and the atmosphere above the Gulf of Mexico and all throughout the United States and the Caribbean is also warming up. And what that means is that the atmosphere can hold more water, a warmer atmosphere holds more water, and a warmer Gulf allows more evaporation from the ocean into the atmosphere. And if you remember, you know, the energy source for hurricanes is that evaporative flux, that flux of water evaporating from the ocean surface. That's what really drives these hurricanes. And so if the Gulf of Mexico warms up, that evaporative flux can go up, which can provide more energy for hurricanes. And in fact, it's an exponential effect. It's not just simple linear. In other words, that you have a small change in temperature, you get a big increase in the evaporative flux, so a big increase in the energy of hurricanes. Whether this particular, you know, storm, you know, I can point at it and say, "Yep, that's climate change." No, I can't do that. But what I can argue is that we may be changing the background conditions so more stronger storms are possible.
So even though this storm might not be the direct result of climate change, you're saying that going forward, we might be able to look for more storms like Harvey, perhaps,
right,
than like storms that we've seen in the past.
That's right. So if for example, if you want to think about Harvey as being, 20 years ago, Harvey may have been a 1-in-100-year storm. Well, you know, with climate change and that increased evaporative flux from the Gulf of Mexico and the warmer atmosphere, Harvey may now be a 1-in-25-year or a 1-in-50-year storm. And 20 years from now, it may be a 1-in-10-year storm. So we may be affecting the statistics of storms quite a bit by changing the climate. But, you know, whether I can't say definitively that Harvey happened because of climate change, but the possibilities of affecting these kinds of Harvey-like storms definitely goes up with climate change. And I would note, you know, the fact that we're so worried about Harvey is because it's sat in place and it just keeps raining. It's not moving much. It just keeps raining and raining and raining. And that stationarity of Harvey, I don't think is related to climate change. That's just just the fact that there's no steering flow. There's nothing that's making Harvey move. And that we don't think that's necessarily a climate change signal.
When you talk about this potentially being maybe a 1-in-50 or 1-in-25 or 1-in-10-year kind of storm,
right,
are you talking about winds, the amount of rain, the duration of it?
Yeah, we can classify each one of those elements differently. The amount of rainfall may turn out to be a 1-in-500-year storm. The strength of the storm may turn out to be a 1-in-10-year storm. So each element that you're critically thinking about, we can actually identify by looking at past storms and the climate system. We can actually classify how often we'd expect that kind of storm.
Does this pose any particular challenge for forecasters to determine any of those factors in terms of how much rain might fall or how strong the winds might be or how long a particular storm might hover over a particular area?
Yeah, it does. So when you think about how storms track, and just in the simplest terms, think of a top spinning on a table. And if you tilt the table and that top slides into a groove and you've tilted the table, you know exactly where that top's going to go. You can imagine that. But now your table is very smooth and it's flat and it's not tilted at all and you've spun that top, there's nothing steering the top. And so you don't really know how long it's going to stay right where it is or where it's going to wander around on the table. So in terms of a forecasting problem, when we have no robust steering flow, no fronts pushing through or strong winds, you know, shift in the jet stream or whatever, if we don't have those things happening at that particular moment in time, forecasting how that storm is going to evolve is pretty tricky. And I would say, you know, the National Weather Service forecasters and National Hurricane Center are really unsung heroes here in doing such an incredible job of actually predicting where that storm would go or not go in this case, given the challenges of the fact that there was no steering flow.
The conditions that you mentioned as far as how climate change affects things potentially sure. in the Gulf, does that affect hurricane conditions elsewhere, for example, like on the Atlantic seaboard?
Absolutely. So the Gulf is, you know, preferentially has warmed up, but the Atlantic has warmed up too. And so we'd expect the same kind of an effect that we're just ever so slowly just increasing ocean temperatures and that increases the evaporative flux. And like I said before, small changes in temperature can lead to relatively large changes in evaporative flux.
How long into the future do you think it will be until sort of this kind of storm is not as uncommon as it is right now?
That's a good question, and that's a really tough one to answer. You know, whether our current modeling technology can answer that question, I think is yet to be seen. That's an area of active science.
All right. Ben Kirtman is a professor of atmospheric science at the University of Miami Rosenstiel School of Marine Atmospheric Science. Ben, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by the Vitalist Health Foundation, the IEEE Foundation, the Arizona Community Foundation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Alliance Bank of Arizona, Beach Fleischmann, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Catherine Fritke, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.